This week on Grape Encounters Radio.
To me, I agree with you.
It doesn't taste right at all.
That's why I said I'd rather drink less often and drink a better product than my daily, you know, have a drink wine. The extracts and stuff like that, I'm not going to buy a $5.99 bottle of wine. I don't need to drink that bad. I'll just drink some beers.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow.
And it is time for your weekly Grape Encounter, and this week we get to talk about something that we have not talked about in a very long time. And to cover this topic, I brought somebody in who is a real expert on the subject. It's one of the things that a lot of people don't talk about who are wine lovers, a thing that they should talk about as wine lovers, and probably one of the most misunderstood aspects of winemaking. We're talking about what has wine lovers over a barrel, or actually in a barrel. We're going to talk about barrels and French barrels in particular today, and oak barrels, of course. And with me today is Ryan Render. He's the director of sales in North America for Caduce of France, right?
That's correct.
Did I just say Caduce of France?
Yeah, I would say Tanellerie Caduce, which means Cooper.
Okay. Tanellerie Caduce of France. Okay. Anyway, hey, great to have you on.
I appreciate you having me on.
You know, it's been a long time since I had anybody talk about barrels. In fact, I'm trying to think of the last person that I had on who did that. You know, I can't even remember. It's going to come to me. In the middle of the discussion, it's going to come to me. But anyway, nice to have you on. Now, you deal with wineries up and down the West Coast, mostly probably, but you've probably got clients in other parts of the country as well.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, basically, we're in Washington, Oregon, all of California, Canada, both sides, Ontario, and also BC. I get to go around to wineries, taste wines with winemakers, and help them evaluate how our barrels and other barrels are influencing.
Oh, you poor baby.
Well, you know, when it's 8 o'clock in the morning and you're drinking high-acid Chardonnays in Oregon, sometimes you should cry for me.
Okay. Well, it's funny because people say that same thing to me because I drink a lot of wine, but too much wine, right?
We taste.
Yeah, we taste. And I do spit. You know, the longer I'm in the industry, the more I spit.
Of course, yeah.
And the better I get at spitting, by the way.
Yeah.
But I think people will say to me, you know, far too often they go, oh, you know, your life is so rough because you have to drink wine all the time.
Well, you know, I get that a lot. My brother is a school teacher, and sometimes I'll text him about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning when I'm doing that thing of tasting wines, in white wines in particular, in the morning in an area that's really known for high acidic wines. It's tough. You know, honestly, it is. You know, you really have to train your palate. You have to understand your spitting. I mean, I could taste up to 15, 20 different barrels at one winery, and then I'm seeing 5 or 6 wineries a day, and it could be a lot.
And you know what? You made a very interesting point. The acidic wines, those are the ones that are tough.
Definitely.
You know, those are the ones that need some food,
for sure,
to make it work. And when you're out tasting wine, you don't generally have a steak with you.
No.
Although I'm thinking that the more I taste, the more I think I'm going to have some good beef jerky there.
There you go.
Because that would help.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, when somebody says, oh, I've got some great food wines for you to taste, it's like, no, I don't want to taste food wines. I want a cocktail wine, please.
Yeah, give me 15% alcohol and up, please, exactly. In the morning. That's what starts my day.
All right, so you're out tasting wine, and people are looking to you to provide them with a barrel that's going to set this wine right.
Yeah, definitely. You know, wine and barrels have a definite center district quality. I mean, you can have different flavors evolve in a barrel depending on where they come from a certain forest or a certain type of oak, certain forest, certain toast levels, all have these different effects on wines. And winemakers generally will have an idea of where they want their wine to go and then watch it evolve. I get to taste with them and watch that wine evolve from basically in pre-malolactic, post-malolactic, and then aging as well. So as well, I get to watch it evolve with them. I get to make the recommendations. And these are clients that I've had for a long time or new clients.
So how do you go about doing that? Because this is a very subjective decision on your part, and you're playing a pretty major role in the winemaking process.
I go about it in a couple different ways. One is I've either tried their wines before and kind of understand where they're coming from, or I get to learn about their wines with them. I know my barrels very well. I've been working for Caduce for about 3 years, but I've been in the business for about 14 of selling barrels. So I know how to evaluate our barrels very well. I know how they come around. around. I know how long it takes, and I can evaluate the kind of the markers that are there before they evolve into something else. So working with the winemaker, I can taste their wines and kind of evaluate and know where the barrel is going to go. And so we talk about that. Or if we haven't had any experience with them, I taste their wines and I ask them about their style, what they like, where the grapes come from, the clones. I go really deep into it. My viticulture background from Cal Poly kind of helped me out with that. So I basically get to understand what they're doing first and then help them evaluate what our barrels are going to do for them.
And are they looking at you and saying, Ryan, we want this particular characteristic, you know, to be prominent in the wine. And then after that, this, this, and this. And, you know, some of that's going to come from the barrel and some of it's not. And then you guide them according to that.
They'll show me different barrels too. They'll show me neutrals. So wine that is in a barrel that they have in their cellar to show me their style, what they already have. And then I'll ask them about what they're looking for. Are they looking for a little bit more structure? Are they looking for a little bit more toastiness? Are they looking for tannin? Basically, I get to help them figure out, or they show me what they're trying to go for, and they ask me about how Caduce is going to influence their wines.
So everybody talks about the grapes. Everybody talks about the terroir. Everybody talks about the winemaker, but not a lot of people really talk about the barrel. We're dismissive about barrels. We say things like, it's 40% new oak, and you'll hear that in a tasting room all the time. So translate a phrase like that.
Well, basically, obviously the percentage of new oak that's in a wine is, you know, if you say 50% oak, so you'd have one in neutral, one in brand new oak. So you'd have 50% new. So basically the breakdown of percentage of new oak that's included in that wine.
But it's based on a barrel having how many uses?
Well, that's another thing. It's like, well, you know, I can use a barrel up to about five times with certain types of wine. You know, in white wines, you can use them a little bit more as far as getting extraction, whether you ferment them or not. Red wines generally extract a little quicker. The higher alcohol content to a wine, the faster the extraction is going to happen. So, you know, 3 to 5 times is basically in that new oak profile.
Now, are we still calling it new oak on the second time and the third time?
I think on the second time people do, you know. I also think people put new French oak or American oak or whatever you have on the label so that it shows that they're adding extra value to the wine. I think oak's gotten a bad name in the last probably 10 years just because of the overuse of it. I mean, I try to use in my own wines, or Rendario try to use the word balance. You know, you want the wines to be balanced, and that includes oak, that includes aging, that includes everything that's done in the vineyards.
Okay, now hold on a second, because you just said in your wines, and I hadn't even told anybody yet that you make wine.
I do.
Yeah, so there is a label. It's Rendario,
yep.
And Ryan makes that. Ryan Render makes,
yep,
Rendario.
That's
because
it.
You always wanted to be Italian or Spanish or what? What?
Rendario.
Rendario, is that Spanish?
Yeah, it's a made-up Italian word.
I
have an Irish-German last name, and it was basically a conversation I had with the great late Dr. Keith Patterson one night. We had a couple glasses of wine, and he kind of spouted it off, and I said, that's going to be the name of my winery someday.
Rendario.
Rendario.
Okay. So I like it.
Yeah.
So you get to be the guinea pig for your own barrels.
I do, and I've worked for a couple different barrel companies in the last 14 years, three different ones. And so each time that I've worked for a different company, I use 100% of their oak exclusively on my wines, on my Chardonnay, on my Syrah, on my Grenache, my Cab, and my Merlot, because I want my customers to understand that I'm using it, and I'll stand on the products I sell them.
Big question is this. Do you get a discount?
I do get a discount, but not as big as I think I should. But, in fact, I think I still owe my company some money from last harvest.
So there are lots of different kinds of oak.
Primarily, yeah. I mean, there's the French oak, American oak, Eastern European, and then we also have talked about before previously about alternatives. And, you know, French oak is kind of the top echelon. It's the, you know, $1,000 and up type of pricing. American oak sits
above. You mean for a barrel?
For a barrel, yes.
Yeah. So an American oak is how far behind that?
It's about $450.
Yeah.
So, I mean, almost cut it in half pretty much.
Why is that?
Sourcing. Also, American oak grows faster than French oak does. It's grown here in the U.S., so there's not a large transportation cost, and it's not managed as well as it is in France.
Now, I mean, oak trees take a while to grow.
About 100 years.
100 years.
Yeah.
So how old are the trees that you're harvesting?
100 to 150 years old.
100 to 150 years.
Yep.
Even here in the U.S.?
No, in the U.S., they're right around 25 years.
So they're ready at 25 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they grow faster. I mean, you'll see the growth earth rings on American oak is a lot wider. There's more access to those forests too in the U.S., so they can go in and buy private land, and you can harvest and make barrels there.
So what do we like better? Now, obviously, you sell just French, right?
For Caduce, I sell
but
just
as a,
French.
As a winemaker, I hear American and French almost evenly. American oak is decent oak, right? Even though it's quite a bit less expensive.
It can be beautiful oak. I've used it on my Merlot in the past, and I love the attributes more of a little bit more coconut, a little bit more higher vanilla content. I love it on for myself, I love it on Merlot, but there's a lot of great American oak out there. If you drink any bourbon, it's all 100% American oak.
Okay. All right. Hey, listen, we're talking to Ryan Render. He's the director of sales for North America for Caduce. They make wine barrels in France, and they make some pretty spectacular barrels, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're up there, right?
Yeah,
in terms of quality, right?
No, high quality.
Okay. We've got all kinds of questions for you because people don't get the barrel thing. You know that.
I'm here to help them.
You go to parties and people go, I don't get the barrel thing.
Oh, they say, oh, oak. I don't like wines with oak. And I said, then you don't like most wines.
Yeah, that's because it's oak juice and extract in there.
Exactly.
That's why you don't like it.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be back with more Grape Encounters right after this.
In wine, there is truth and sulfites and occasionally a few insect parts. You learn something every day on Grape Encounters Radio.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain.
And now, here's the guy who went from hipster to sipster, David Wilson.
Right behind the rain.
And we are back with Grape Encounters Radio. And you know, when somebody says they want some oaky wine, it does not mean that they want wine from Oklahoma. They want wine with oak in it. You know, oak influences the final outcome of a wine just about as much as the grapes do. It's just as important. We only seem to talk about the grapes. Well, today we're talking to somebody who knows a lot about grapes and a lot about oak because he is the director of sales in North America for Caduce, and they are based in France.
Yep, we're based in Beaune, France. So just outside of Beaune, about 10 minutes, Le Douar-Sarnier. I think I've massacred that name a million times, but we make about 14,000 to 16,000 barrels a year, so it's relatively small in the grand scheme of things. Bigger coopers make anywhere from 50 to 100. $150,000 a year.
Wow. And this is Ryan Render talking, by the way. I didn't even get a chance to say that. And Ryan makes wine as well.
I do. You know, I've been making my own wine for Rendario Vineyards, which is my label, since 2003. I started off up in Sonoma, moved back down to Paso. I went to Cal Poly and studied there and started making wines in 98 and moved around a little bit during college at Domaine Alfred. That actually worked for a handful of other little wineries and have never missed a harvest since then.
And I buy his wines.
More importantly.
Yeah, just started. And they're delicious.
Thank you. I appreciate
Crazy
that.
Crazy delicious.
Yeah, you know
the Chardonnay.
Yeah, the Chardonnay is
the
great.
Chardonnay is just like out of the park.
I love it. You know, a great friend of mine, Charlie Wagner up at Miresoleil, allows me to pick fruit up there and make it into wine. And it's called Bajaja. And it was named after an adventure that him and I and his cousins took in 2005 down to Mexico on our motorcycles.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, there's a video made that only I have, I believe, at this point in time. And it's all of our shenanigans that we pulled down there.
Okay. So you have a personal relationship.
For sure. No, definitely.
Other members of the Wagner family?
Yeah. You know, I know Joe pretty well. I saw him last week. We're up at a Cook in Napa, and he's doing great. You know, he sold his Mayomi brand, I think, for $316 million and has a—
Come on. That's just crazy, right?
It's crazy. You know what? God bless him, because that just sets the bar even higher. And now he has a Copper Cane wine and provisions, which is a handful of brands that he does from Napa, Oregon. He's picking up some brands down in Santa Barbara County as well. So he's on a great roll.
And he's got a bunch of money in his pocket. I heard that. I couldn't even believe that, you know, and there wasn't the tangible asset value there to justify
that. There wasn't a big winery. There wasn't anything.
Nothing, right.
I mean, it's like the Randall Graham approach. It's like the prisoner approach. You know, you build these brands up that have marketability. I mean, you think he went from 60,000 cases to 700,000 cases within a few years, which is remarkable.
Seemed to me like that all started with Ménage à Trois.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether they were the first to become the big brand where the name got so valuable or not.
But I don't know when they sold. I remember when Bonnie Dune sold, and that was the first one for me that was noticeable, that it had nothing attached to it, no vineyards, no winery. It was just a brand.
I'm hoping that somebody just buys me as a brand. Yeah.
Rendario is always for sale, by the way.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Now, you shouldn't do.
I'll take a little bit less.
Your wines are very good.
Thank you.
You know what? If you're gonna sell it, you need to stay attached to the wine.
Definitely. That's my passion. I love making wine. I love being in the community. I've been in the wine industry for about 18 years now. That's something I want to hand off to my kids. Once they get old enough, they've already done their first few harvests, and they're only 3 and 5.
So let's talk about the making of the oak barrel for a second, because that's so interesting.
Yeah.
You make these wood staves.
It starts earlier than that. You know, it starts out with growing the timber, and that starts with the ONF, the French National Forestry Service, that methodically handles and curates these wood, this forest. They go through, there's two different types of forests. There's taillis and outfoutés. Taillis is basically private forest that you can buy wood off of, and then there's outfoutés, which is superior growth, which is managed by the ONF, the French National Forestry Service. So they'll go through every 10 years and reduce. It basically starts in like a thicket of trees, and they let them grow, get tall, and then they go through and systematically choose which trees are going to be cut, and then they allow them to grow bigger and bigger and wider. Then the Forestry Service goes through, measures the trees, makes the evaluation of which one should be cut down. They cut them down, and then they go to a auction, and that's where competing companies can bid on the wood. Then they get them shipped to them. Then we cut them into basically what they're called bowls, which are larger pieces of wood, and then chop them into staves, split them into staves, and then hand saw them, and then create the staves.
There's got to be a lot of waste, right?
There is, actually.
A lot of waste.
But, you know, there's also secondary services, pallets, different wood companies, furniture, veneer, a lot of different services. So, I mean, the tree doesn't get 100% used, but it does, does come down to basically you can use a lot of different things of the tree.
Now, does any of it become oak chunks that are then put into sleeves and put in the barrel?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of defects in the woods. I mean, think of what has happened in the last 100 years in Europe. Well, we've had a few wars through there. So we'll find trees from certain forests that actually have bullets in them that'll have, basically the trees were shot at a young age. And so you can see the bullets. You can see where it had pierced it and killed it. Yeah, it's pretty interesting to see. So at that point, they're turned into staves. And at staves, we basically age them for about 30 months outside in what we call a chimney stack, which basically looks like Lincoln logs, so that we can basically get rid of the harsher acids and allow nature to kind of take its course.
So how does it work exactly? Exactly. You create the staves first, okay? And then how do they put it together and keep it from leaking? I don't get it.
Well, oak's one of the...
They should leak.
Yeah, they should, you know. And there's no glue or... I mean, there's minimum nails.
No.
But I mean, you know... So basically, from the stave, they're routed. They're jointed. After seasoning, they're jointed. And then basically, pressure is all that keeps them together. I mean, oak is one of the, I think, four species of wood that actually holds liquid. So that's one of the primary uses of why we use oak, is because it actually holds Quercus sessilflora as the main... species of oak that we use.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how do you become a cooper?
Okay.
And how do you build the barrel? I mean, because I know an aside, but every time I look at a barrel, I just go, wow, that's pretty cool. How did they – I couldn't make that.
Right. No, it's
right. Have you tried?
Yeah, I have.
You have tried.
I've tried. So when we give tours of the cooperage, some of the coopers I've worked for, there's a stage called the Rose, and that's basically putting the first ring together with all the staves. So it's basically like a puzzle piece, and you got to hold it really carefully and really strongly as you move around. There's about 34 staves in a barrel, so you basically got to put it together. They're all jointed so that when they're actually put together, they'll hold. But you got to get that first ring on, and that's the tough one. So basically, you got to put that on, and it takes a lot of skill and practice. You have to be an apprentice for, I believe, 3 years before you can actually become a cooper, and you have to do every single thing the old traditional way with old tools. You have to make your own barrel. You have to put together your tools. You have to sharpen them every day. You have to build them. It's an apprenticeship. It's really an amazing a talent and skill to have.
Why can't we just mechanize it, you know? Just run it through a machine.
You know, it still takes that human touch, you know, that
good.
Those first couple of stages. I mean, a cooper is a very skilled individual. It has been mechanized a lot, some of the joining and also the pressure in the making of the crows and the chime, which are parts of the barrel near the head, has been mechanized. But you still need that human touch for sure.
Yeah. Amazing. All right. We're talking to Ryan Render. He is the director of sales in North America for Caduce Barrel Makers in France and making amazing barrels. We're going to talk next about something that's going to make Ryan's skin crawl.
Uh-oh.
We're going to talk about all of the ways that winemakers fool us into believing that real oak was used. Well, in some cases it is used, but that the wine that you're tasting was made in an oak barrel. Aged in an oak barrel, when in reality, no such thing happened. And we'll do that next on Grape Encounters Radio.
connecting winemakers, wine lovers, wine adventures, and all things wine from around the globe. You are listening to Grape Encounters Radio with David Wilson, broadcasting from our wine cellar studio in idyllic Atascadero, centrally located in the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California. And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
Roll out the barrel.
Back with Grape Encounters Radio, and pleased to finally have a discussion about oak. It is something that we talk about very rarely on this show, and really should talk about all the time, because it's as important as the grapes, for sure. At least that's what I believe, and I'm pretty sure my guest Ryan Render believes that as well.
I do.
Director of Sales for Caduce. Again, tell us about Caduce, French company.
So we're a French company that's based in Beaune, France. We manufacture wine barrels over there. We source all of our wood from our parent company, Canadel, also co-owned by one of the largest Burgundy producers, so Maison Louis Jadot. So we're basically a cooper that was created because Maison Louis Jadot wanted to do all their barrels in-house. Well, the barrels turned out so well that some of the neighbors wanted them, so we started selling them to our neighbors, and then we moved over here to the U.S. in 95.
Now, do you think that you could go out, find the wood, and have a barrel made on your own now?
I definitely could find that wood.
You could,
yes,
do it.
I could do it. I've been over to France enough. I know enough people that if I wanted to do that, I don't think I could raise up the money to be able to get that done. But I definitely have the contacts.
All right. So first question where oak is concerned, something that is on probably almost every wine lover's mind when they think about oak. What the heck happened with Chardonnay?
ABC, you mean? Anything but Chardonnay?
What happened to Chardonnay? Chardonnay was delicious. Then it got so oaky, and then it went to no oak. And now it seems like we have like three choices of Chardonnays. Is that about right?
I think so. I think it was the Desperate Housewives scenario. Basically, people that wanted a wine that they could taste a lot of, that gave them that sensation. And I think it also was a lot of wines that were going heavy into the malolactic forum too. You have malolactic, which creates that buttery component in wine, and then you have oak. Well, a lot of the oak was basically being amplified by that malolactic, so you got buttery popcorn and oak, and it was very obvious for people to taste. So I think new wine drinkers were really liking it up until a point, and then they reverted, say 5-6 years ago. They wanted anything that didn't have oak on it to be no oak, you know, all these different ones, stainless steel, for which I don't particularly care for. I like balance. And so if you look at some of the great wines, they're balanced wines. You know, they have oak in them because I think oak is, especially with Chardonnay, is really an important part of the production.
And I don't really like unoaked Chardonnays. I think the medium oaked Chardonnays are really the best. But, you know, we have this tendency in this country to make decisions based on the belief that if a little is good, a lot is better.
Exactly.
And that's not the case with the Chardonnay.
No, I mean, Chardonnay is a beautiful, beautiful creature. I mean, I was, when I was over there in France, in Beaune, probably about a decade ago, I was on that I didn't like Chardonnay anymore kick. I was one of those people that's like, there's too much oak, there's too much butter. Well, if you go over there, they actually use a lot of oak on their barrels, but you can't tell because the wines have such great acid, great components, great, as you say, terroir. And so there's basically this rejuvenation with me. So I came back and wanted to make Chardonnay. I can't make Burgundy-style Chardonnay in California. It just can't be done. But I make a wine that, for me, is a balanced wine.
When a barrel's been used a couple of times, if you wanted to get the same impact from the oak that you would get the first time you used it, are you staying in the barrel longer? Is that the way it's done?
You can. You know, for me, I actually really enjoy the second fill to a barrel because barrels can be big and overwhelming at first. And then once they get that 1 year seasoning from the wine, it seems to mellow down a little bit and really become really elegant and finessed.
Okay. Explain toast.
Toast levels. Okay.
So
barrels get toasted. They get toasted over many different sources. You could have wood chips. You can have gas, electric. At Caduce, we do things very traditionally. So they're over oak pellets that we've grinded up and made a fuel source out of. So we're reusing any extra products we're making into our fuel product. So toast levels, you start off with light. So that's probably about 60 minutes on the fire, 60, 70 minutes on the fire. And then you move up to there from medium plus. We do a medium plus plus, and we do a heavy toast. as you increase your toast levels, you're basically cooking out you're cooking the sugar. So it's called the Maillard reaction. And so basically you're cooking the sugars inside the wood's grain to come out and to come to the surface. So you'll get less tannin and more spice and more smoke as the barrels get toasted higher and higher.
So what's the most popular barrel for winemakers?
It really depends on the style of wine you're making. Here in Paso Robles, most winemakers enjoy medium plus. Where up in Oregon, you see a lot of mediums. In Washington, you see a lot of medium and medium plus. You know, it just depends on you're making Cabernet, you're making Pinot Noir, you're making a Chardonnay. So it really depends on what the winemaker is going for and the style of wine that they're creating.
Yeah, gotcha. All right, let's talk about the fakes.
The fakes.
They're always trying to fake us out, Ryan. They are. And, you know, I know a winemaker who makes a Zinfandel that is absolutely delicious here in this region. And I happen to know that he uses neutral barrels. In other words, they've had all the flavor sucked out of them. But he puts a sleeve in the barrels mm-hmm. full of chopped up chunks of oak, mm-hmm. which because they're small pieces, they leach the flavor of the oak much more quickly than if he had just used the whole barrel.
There's a lot of products out there. I think you're referring to what they call a daisy chain or a chain. You can put staves on the inside of a barrel. You can use powders, chips, beans, dominoes. Basically, it's trying to mimic the flavor of oak, vanilla, and the toastiness with it. The problem comes is when – well, I should say problem, but basically they're doing it because they're looking for a less expensive alternative to buying a $400 to $500 to $1,000 barrel, but trying to get some of those flavors because their consumers may not know the difference. Most of the barrels that I sell, those wines that go into them, are $25 and up. At a $20 price point, you basically start running out of the ability to turn a profit on your wines if you're using a higher-end product.
But when I take a sleeve that has chunks of oak in it, I'm really doing the same thing, right?
You're technically adding oak in there. I mean, you could technically take vanilla extract if you're so inclined illegally and put it inside your barrel and there's vanilla flavor. What you really want to do is you want to give your wine a home and a host to basically evolve. The oak flavor from those chains and everything else, to me, it's very overt. You know, it's not refined. It's not elegant. It's not finessed. It's big and it's sweet. And to me, that's too much.
So we've got the oak chunks. We've got oak extract. That's a really interesting one.
Yeah.
Well, that's taken basically from – we extract the juice from, I guess, pieces of oak, right?
Yeah. You know, you can get tannin, which they're extracting. Vanilla, you can get it, you know, not only from wood but from other sources and stuff like that, other plant material. In Europe, they can do it a lot more readily than we can here in the U.S. But, you know, these big wines that you like for $10, you know, I can guarantee that those don't see any barrel and they see a lot of other products go in there. You probably have no idea what they are. I would rather buy a wine for a little bit more expensive, drink less often, and drink something that's made from grapes, yeast, and barrels than anything else.
So the tannin is basically coming from a sort of semi-fake source.
Yeah.
The flavor is – we're faking it basically, but maybe using natural products.
Yeah, it's an extract, as you said. So it's an extracted flavor from
source. It doesn't taste right.
To me, I agree with you. You know, I don't –
it doesn't taste right at all.
That's why I said I'd rather drink less often and drink a better product made by someone who's actually taking the time to go into making a high-quality product than my daily, you know, have a drink wine.
Have you ever been fooled?
Not that I know of. You know, honestly, I mean, I go, hey, that tastes pretty good for what it is. I mean, for, you know, $14 or for, you know, $9.99, I go, that's pretty solid. You know, I know that, you know, a great local company, J. Lohr, does a lot of alternatives, but they use a lot of barrels too. Yeah. And their wines, you know, honestly, for the price are great. You know, I've tasted them a bunch. The winemaking team is excellent, you know, and they've done a lot of great things in that area. And also the products themselves, those alternatives, they've gotten a lot better. When I first started 14 years ago selling barrels, that it was pretty harsh. You know, nowadays they've actually evolved into a lot better products. They're using better woods as far as the stave quality. The extracts and stuff like that, that's just – I'm not going to buy a $5.99 bottle of wine. I don't need to drink that bad. I'll drink some beers.
All right. Well, very interesting stuff. If somebody is sitting in a tasting room and they're faced with the question of whether to buy the wine that was aged in American oak or French oak or Hungarian oak. How do we decide?
You're not going to decide.
Taste the wine,
you,
right?
You know, unless they're going to tell you, most likely you're going to have no idea if they used barrels, American oak, French oak. You can ask them, you know, but that's one of the things. And I think that's why the alternatives have gone up so much, is that most consumers don't know, you know, and they honestly don't care. And so it's my job to kind of make sure the winemakers do care, and that's what, and to promote my products through them, because they're trying to make the best wine possible. When you drink it, you're drinking their expression.
All right. That is going to do it.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you coming in.
Had a great time.
Yeah, I had a great time having you here. If somebody wanted more information, is there an interesting website we could send
people
to?
Yeah, for www.tonnellerycaduce.com, or just Google Caduce Cooperage.
So it's Tonnellery, which is T-O-N-N-E-L-L-E-R-I-E. Spell that. Caduce is C-A-D-U-S.com.
Yep.
That's it.
Thank you.
End of story. Ryan, thanks a lot.
I appreciate it.
Can you bring a barrel by here next time?
That and some samples.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, with some of their Rindario wine in it.
Yes,
that'd be
definitely
fantastic.
Definitely. Let's do that.
No, you've got that down pat. Which do you like more, making wine or making money selling barrels?
I like making wine more.
Okay, that's honesty. All right. Well, Caduce, I'm glad you're in France. All right, we'll be back with more Grape Encounters right after this.
You'll find Grape Encounters Radio located at the corner of Fermented and Demented. You do have a GPS, don't you?
Yeah, wise guy, eh?
She once described a wine as a dusty old trunk from the attic, and we were all glad she was doing the sipping. It's Sipping with Sarah, with Sunset Magazine's Sarah Schneider, on Grape Encounters Radio with David Wilson.
When your face is pictured on the pages, when your name is out there on the scene, when your world is quickly rearranging, when your pictures are appearing on the pages of the magazine.
Back with Grape Encounters Radio, and in the studio now, the lovely Sarah Schneider. Today we're going to talk about something that you wanted to definitely get out there. It's a subject near and dear to my heart.
I think that you're talking about wines by the glass in restaurants.
And how it's changed. There have been a couple of real game changers in the past few years.
There have been wines by the glass on most restaurant lists for a very long time, but it has been a crapshoot as to how good those wines are.
Good meaning two things.
Right.
The quality of the wine in general and the condition of the wine.
And the condition of the wine. How sound is it?
Yeah.
And that's because they are poured from bottles, and you want a kind of rare wine that they have put by the glass. You might have been the only one to order a glass in the last 3 days, and that bottle was open 3 days ago, and the staff really doesn't want to pour out 2/3 of a bottle, so they serve it anyway, and the wine is oxidized. And I have friends working in the industry who have told me that is way, way, way too often the case.
Honestly, and I mean this sincerely, 2 out of 3 glasses of wine are tainted in some way that I have in the past ordered by the glass. The first thing that you want to do when you're in a restaurant is find out how often they're uncorking those bottles, because chances are the more obscure the wine is that you order by the glass, the greater the chance that that wine has been in the bottle, maybe even 2 weeks. It happens.
Yikes.
And not everybody throws the wine away. And even if they're using some kind of a preservation system like a vacuum vin, or they're spraying argon gas like private preserve into the bottle, it still is only going to give that wine, if it's a red wine especially, 3 days is going to be max. And anything beyond that, the wine's done.
So if you were in a high volume restaurant with lots of wine coming out to tables,
right,
you're better off.
Yeah. If it's a small restaurant that's not selling a lot of wine, that wine is going to be in bad shape. But here's the good news. The good news is that when you get a tainted glass of
wine and it's clearly turned and you send it back, they now have to open another bottle and you're going to get a fresh glass of wine from the bottle and you should not be afraid to send the wine back. So how would you describe oxidation so that people know when they're tasting something that's tainted?
It's wine on its way to turning into vinegar.
But wine can't turn to vinegar on its own. It needs vinegar mother.
That is true. It just turns to a really badly oxidized product.
Yeah. It's doing, it's going through the
same
process.
It's going through the same process, but it won't turn into a tasty thing.
It's not going to be. Don't save it and try to put it on your salad later because you need the vinegar mother for that to happen. Okay. So the solutions you were going to talk about.
And that is the practice of wineries kegging their wine. That is sending it to a company like Free Flow Wines in Napa that puts it into stainless steel kegs and distributes it to restaurants to serve on tap. So wines on tap, I'm telling you, in much of the western part of the country and even the East Coast, there's almost no new restaurant that opens that doesn't have a number of taps devoted to wine. And it allows them to pull a glass of wine, like you'd pull a beer, and some gas shoots in to cover the surface of that wine in the keg to keep the oxygen out.
So are they using argon or nitrogen? What are they using?
I think many of them are using argon.
Yeah. Being the preferred gas,
right,
for sure. Yeah.
Right. And if it's a wine that's meant to be drunk when it's fairly young and fresh, red or white, you will get a very sound, fresh glass of wine. And I am so for it.
And by the way, if you are ordering wines that are served from a keg or even wines that are boxed these days, so many of the really good wineries are doing this.
Oh, they are.
So just because it's on tap does not mean at all that it is a low quality wine.
Absolutely not.
It's just the opposite, actually.
I know
it's
that
true.
You're based on the Central California coast. There are a ton of wineries all around you that are kegging. Just beautiful examples like Tablas Creek. In Paso Robles is kegging a lot of their wines. Tangent down in Edna Valley with all of their alternative whites. You'll find their Albarino on tap, their Grenache Blanc.
Another thing that's very interesting about all of this is that when a winery doesn't have to pay for bottling, labeling, corking, they're actually able to sell that wine for a lot less money, which means that a glass of wine is going to cost a lot less money if it's coming out of a keg than if it's coming out of a bottle.
And the other side that warms my heart is that the carbon footprint of that wine just plummets. It's a fraction of what it would be if it got sent out in a bottle with all of that glass being shipped and having to be recycled or not. It's really environmentally sound way to drink your wine.
Okay, so there are a couple of other things that are game changers as well. And the most important, I think, these days is the Coravin.
I would agree with you there.
We advertise Coravin on this show, but not because of any other reason except that I really believe in this product. Everybody ought to have one. And every restaurant for sure should have one.
Right.
Because
and many do.
You don't have to throw away wine anymore. And what's really cool about it is that you are now able to sell really high-end wine by the glass. And a lot of people don't want to spend $150 to buy a bottle of wine because they don't want to take that risk. But for $25 for a glass of that wine, it's pure pleasure for them. And they get to try it without putting a bunch of money out there.
Right. Even though that's a hefty price for a glass of wine, but it could be just a terrific discovery. So if you see some fairly expensive wines being served by the glass, you can probably know that they've got a Coravin back there, the device that sticks a needle through the cork without pulling the cork and pulls off a glass of wine, preserving the rest of the bottle. And you might just ask them.
Yeah, I think that's a very important question. If you are in a place that is selling pricey wine by the glass, you need to know whether they're using some sort of an argon-based or nitrogen-based system, which is either going to be a Coravin or something like an Enomatic, which is a machine that dispenses wine from the bottles. And usually they hold like 8 bottles and they add argon to the bottle as they subtract the wine from the bottle. And so the wine stays pretty pristine. But the machines are very expensive. I think they're something close to $20,000.
Yikes.
So a lot of places don't have them yet. And sooner or later, I think they'll be a probably less expensive version, but I have 2 of them.
Oh,
yes.
And at your wine bar?
Yes, we do. And they,
good to know.
I've never had to throw a drop of wine away that has been poured out of an Enomatic.
Good to know.
So we have that and the Corbin. So just ask. If you're going to spend anything more than a few dollars for a glass of wine, you have every right to ask how the wine is kept and preserved, because if all they're doing is just shoving the cork back in it, the wine is going to be tainted, probably. And if it is tainted, you should have no reservations about sending it back. Do it, and then they'll open a fresh bottle, and you're the winner. All right. That's going to do it for Sippin' with Sarah. Sarah Schneider from Sunset Magazine.
You never know what part of the country or the world the Grape Encounters microphones will take you to. Don't miss a single experience. Your Grape Encounter isn't over. We're just taking a breather until next week's edition.